And welcome back to Fully Equipped, Golf.com's Gear Focus podcast, where we take weekly PGA Tour news related to golfers of all skill levels. I'm Tim Breon, Senior Vice President of True Spec Golf, joined by my partners Jonathan Wall, Managing Editor for Equipment for Golf.com, and Senior Equipment Writer for Golf.com, Andrew Tursky. What's up, guys?
What's going on, Professor?
Jersey stand up.
Yeah, there you go. The return, what's going on is the return of competitive golf, kind of. Obviously, last week, got to see some golf on TV. I'm not going to lie, it was a pretty cool Sunday between the event out at the TaylorMade Driving for Relief match and then followed up with the last couple episodes of The Last Dance. It was actually a decent sports viewing weekend, but this coming weekend we've got a really cool opportunity to take a look at Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson and Tom Brady and Peyton Manning. So should be fun. And then right,
we've got a Tiger documentary following it too. Today.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, man. So
about the Tiger Slam, should be good.
Yeah. So you know, things are starting to at least resemble some sort of normalcy. At least in, you know, trying to get things going in the golf world again. You know, some news coming out of the different tours over the course of the last couple of weeks. I know the LPGA is going to be delayed a little bit longer, but exciting to get back to, you know, competitive golf. And it was awesome to see this last weekend. So we'll just chat about the match last weekend and the one coming up, and then toss it to an interview. I know you guys had an opportunity to spend some time with one of the guys from Callaway, who's, you know, kind of primarily responsible for Phil's gear. So we'll be able to kind of dive into what Phil's going to have in the bag when he plays the match this weekend. So it should be a cool episode as we start to get back to our regular format. So what'd you guys think of the match this last weekend?
You know, I thought it was good. I was more excited than anything else to see Seminole. First time in 91 years that it was gracing a television screen. And, you know, that to me, I think, was the, you know, I thought it kind of topped the match. You know, yeah. For the most part, the overall play, it really didn't feel like it had very much juice. I mean, we had Dustin Johnson on the first green using a tee to mark his golf ball because he didn't have a ball marker. It just kind of makes you, you know that caddies are important.
Yep.
Even when it comes to stuff like handing out ball markers and making sure their guys are good to go, you know, DJ showing up on the first green with a tee and not a ball marker, I thought was pretty hilarious. But yeah, seeing Seminole was the, you know, the thing I was most excited about. It definitely exceeded expectations. But
you thought Seminole exceeded expectations for real? Like, you're not lying?
Yeah, seriously. I thought the golf course looked great. You know, it is one of those that I feel like there are two camps, and I wonder if you guys agree. There are those that love Seminole and think that it deserves its ranking, and there are those that think that it's highly overrated.
I was seeing it for the first time, and I definitely thought it was overrated.
It seemed like
a bunch of courses, at least the front nine. It kind of kicked up on the back nine, but it looked like a bunch of courses I've played in Florida where you just go out in a cart. You load up the cooler with beers. It just looked like a resort course to me, honestly.
We're going to be when I get back to Scottsdale, I'm going to be swinging at you, Tursky. You and I are going to go into octagon together on that one, because you couldn't be any more wrong, and I understand how it shows on TV.
You're going to fight me over Seminole?
Yeah.
You're going to fight me over Seminole.
You got to remember that he worked there.
I'm not playing the course.
Yeah. So
I didn't play the course. I saw it for the first time on TV.
So the situation there at that golf course that doesn't show up on TV is there are two massive sand ridges that bisect the golf course right down the middle. And, you know, as you know, having played South Florida golf, you don't get a lot of elevation and topography change. And so you do have about 40, 50 feet of topography change all over the golf course, starting right on the second hole where you hit it into a flat spot in the second fairway, then go up that 40-foot sand dune. And so that's something that doesn't really show well on television. The other thing that doesn't...
Hey, Tim.
Yeah?
Tim.
Yeah?
You said you wanted to fight me over my take, and then you said you agree that it doesn't show up well on TV.
It doesn't show well on TV, not to the full magnitude of the golf course. I thought the golf course did show well on television. You know, the idea that you can see clear across the property from 18 all the way to, you know, number 6 or 7, that's kind of unique. That's something you don't get in a lot of golf courses. And then as far as the condition of the golf course, unfortunately, you know, I can attest this myself with all of the rain that we've had coming down in the last couple of days. I'm actually in South Florida right now. It just played kind of soft. The thing about Seminole is the firmness of the greens. And unfortunately, that was, you know, not on full display because of all the rain that they'd received. You know, normally, a lot of those shots that they hit onto the, you know, kind of working towards the shoulders of the greens would never stay put, and they would roll off the green. I've had a lot of really good friends, elite players, that have said that I've never played Seminole without putting at least one shot off the green, you know, putting the ball off the green. So with the greens as wet as they were, that wasn't happening. But, you know, the really neat thing about that golf course is that visually, it doesn't scare you like a Pete Dye golf course will. But when you count them up at the end of the round, you have no idea why you shot so high. And most of the time, it's because of what's going on around the greens and on the greens. So it was fun to see the golf course and you know, get its credit. And, you know, the golf itself, I think Ricky was the only one that kind of played worth a darn. I think it was pretty mediocre otherwise. Just seeing guys on the golf course again was amazing. But it brought a couple things to mind, guys. You know, as the tour gets going again, I don't think that there's been a definitive resolution about caddies yet. And I know that, you know, as far as the equipment vans, as we've discussed, there are going to be quite a few events where the vans aren't, you know, they don't have access to the vans like they have usually. For some players, these two factors don't really factor in. Some players don't use their caddies that often. Other guys are very dependent upon their caddies. And then as far as the equipment vans, as you guys know, some of them are in the vans every week and some people stay away from them. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
They'll have caddies. I think they'll for sure have caddies.
They have to.
I just think that their contact, you're going to have players pulling clubs out of the bag instead of caddies. And some players said that, you know, on par threes, especially, they're pulling their own club out of the bag. Sometimes maybe not from the middle of the fairway. That might take a bit of getting used to. You know, the one thing that will be interesting, and Andrew and I talked to Johnny Thompson, who's a senior tour rep for Callaway, about this a little bit. But it's going to be very different for the tour reps when they're working with players. You know, for the most part, players are able to move in and out of the equipment trucks in the range, and reps are able to get to the range and hand off product. And it's usually a pretty seamless process when it comes to testing gear. I've spoken to a couple of reps who've said that things are going to be changing significantly. There's going to be a holding area for clubs, which means that the reps will have somebody building the clubs in the truck. They'll then go and they'll drop the clubs off in a holding area. It might be like a bin or a spot where their product usually goes, and the player or caddy can come by and pick it up. And that's how they're going to try and avoid having players inside the trucks, is by using this holding area. But it's going to make the process completely different, because the player and caddy are going to need to go over and get the product. They're not going to be able to wait on the rep to just bring it to them. So there are some significant changes coming to the way that reps and players work together on a weekly basis.
We've also seen some movement when you're talking about tour reps. You know, you're going to see some things transpire over the next week. And I know last week Callaway made some cuts, a couple of surprising cuts actually. And that affected their tour department as well as Odyssey Putters. You know, I think we're starting to see the effects of this.
Well, I think we should mention those.
Yeah, for sure.
I think we should mention those, Tim. You know, Austin Rawlinson. Tim, I think you were the one. As the biggest surprise as this might be, I don't have a Facebook account. So, you know, I'm not able to keep up with how things are going there. But you pointed it out. It looks like Austin Rawlinson is out at Odyssey. And he was an instrumental
kind of was Odyssey. I mean, let's be real.
Exactly. He kind of was. So that's a pretty significant move. One that we really should have mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Tim, that we kind of glossed over, John Oldenburg.
Yep.
As you mentioned.
Pain.
What did you hear there?
So he left LAGP, and replacing him at LAGP is Jeff Meyer. Jeff Meyer was most recently part of the TPT group. We know TPT kind of bust on the scene last year and then had some challenges towards the end of the year. Prior to TPT, kind of Jeff's you know, major achievement or so to speak in the industry. He was part of the G. Loomis group back in the day, and G. Loomis, you know, they, Davis Love had the first set of carbon fiber iron shafts from G. Loomis, and you know, G. Loomis is known as fishing pole manufacturers, but they got into the golf shaft world for a few years. So Jeff is replacing John, and we've had John on the pod. And then obviously,
and John was head designer. For people that don't know that are listening, he was the one who was designing all of the product.
Yep.
For LAGP.
And when you look at his products that he had,
pretty significant change for them.
Yeah. And when you look at the products that, you know, he has designed throughout his career, as we mentioned on the interview with John, you know, he's kind of the goat of iron, of carbon fiber shaft design over the last 20 years anyways. You know, and considering that carbon fiber shafts haven't been around, you know, that long, it kind of makes him the GOAT, period. When you're talking about major championships, his designs have been in more major champions bags than any other designer. You know, the Aldila RIP, the Aldila NV, and most recently was with LAGP. One of the tour players that I work with, we actually just put him in a LAGP Toronto, which is the product that was designed for Bryson. And, you know, the thing has just performed amazingly well throughout testing and on the golf course. So I think that as people get more familiar with some of those products that he designed under the LAGP label, and now he's taking on a position at Ping, which is a really interesting move for me, because Ping is kind of one of the group, you know, one of the manufacturers that have said for years, listen, the shaft is important, but the club head is more important than the shaft. And they've always kind of done their own proprietary shafts or had some proprietary shafts under their offerings, especially in their stock shafts with Woods. And so bringing, you know, Ole on board, you know, what does that mean as far as their proprietary shafts that they're using? Obviously, they have some plans here to start producing some really high-end, some really nice stuff if he's part of the team. And it's also worth mentioning, he's not just a shaft guy, he's also a materials guy. So that could be another reason why they're bringing him in. Maybe it's not necessarily just shafts. Maybe it could be due to, you know, trying to develop some cutting edge materials to be used in club heads. You know, everybody's using carbon fiber crowns and soles and things like that these days. So, but it'll be interesting to see where Ole takes his experience with Ping. And I'm excited to get to work with him a little more closely out in Scottsdale. It'll be awesome for me because I'm going to have kind of an unbiased shaft guy that knows more than most folks at my disposal to pick his brain regarding shaft products. So, really interesting. And as you mentioned, you know, Aussie Rollinson with Odyssey, I mean, 1990 something, 95 or 6, I think it was, that he kind of was part of the Odyssey team and has been driving that forward for a long time. So not being part of the Odyssey crew, it kind of tells me that maybe Callaway is looking to emphasize Toulon a little bit more. That's just, you know, complete, you know, I'm reading between the lines here, but maybe they're trying to prop up the Toulon line a little bit more. I don't know, but either way, you know, we're starting to see some pieces move around the board. We're starting to see some pieces move around the board as far as, you know, these scientists and designers and industry people, as I think we all expected that coming through this pandemic, that there was going to be some attrition and some movement. With that, let's get into, you know, actually there's one other gear note from Seminole I wanted to go over with you guys. What'd you think of Ricky's irons?
Fire.
Yeah, they were awesome. Beautiful. They look so awesome.
They look great in the sunlight.
Yeah. Super eye-catching.
You know, they looked really good when I saw the initial photos that they sent out, but seeing them in the wild, they look even better. I can't wait to check them out in person.
Yep.
But yeah, they're as good as advertised. I think based on the comments that I was seeing from people when we posted photos of it on social, there are going to be a lot of excited buyers when these irons come to retail in the fall.
For sure.
At Fully Equipped Golf on Instagram to check out photos.
That's right. There you go, Tursky.
That's right, buddy.
And I love the name on it, right? The Rev 33. 33 revisions. Kind of interesting, you know?
The Pippin irons.
Yeah.
That's what I said.
Yeah, I love it.
Tursky's got the Bulls pennant behind him in the background. So I'm waiting for them to steal my idea and use it. Try and get Scotty using those irons.
Yeah, that's right. What did you guys think of the ending of The Last Dance? Pretty neat, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean it was awesome. I'm gonna have to go back and watch it again.
I love this stuff about Kerr's dad and Gus, the security guard, and all that.
That's awesome.
you know,
the super stuff that even if you're like
segments.
Even if you're like a rabid Bulls fan and you grew up during that time, like we all did, it's still, I mean, there were a lot of stories that I had never heard before. So, yeah, that's the whole reason you watch something like that is to learn something new. Also the nostalgia, but yeah, learn something new, I think, is always really fun.
I've got a kind of funny Jordan story, actually, that ties into golf. So he was a member at my club in Birmingham, Alabama. When he played for the Barons, he played out at a place called Greystone. And that was where I worked for TaylorMade. Had a fitting center out there. So he would come out once a year. He owns a motorcycle racing team, and he's big into this motorcycle racing team. And they would race at Barber.
Of course he does.
Yeah, and they would race at Barber Motor Speedway, which is like this big motorcycle, you know, event. It's like a Daytona of motorcycle racing, so to speak. So he would come out to Birmingham for the entire week and bring his whole entourage out to Greystone, and it was like a production. So all the staff is fanboying him and taking pictures, and I'm like, man, that's just so tacky. I don't want to go do that. You know, I don't want to be that guy. So I'm walking through the locker room, and I look to my right, and what's sitting on the floor in front of his locker but Jordan's. And I'm looking over there going, man, those are J's. I got to put those things on. So I run over there, put on the shoes, stand up, and who am I looking at face to face as soon as I do it? Michael Jordan, the most awkward moment in my career. And he's like, can I help you, man? He's
like, wearing his shoes.
I'm wearing his shoes. Why? It's unreal, man.
Why would you put his shoes on?
They're Jordan's, man. They're J's. Like, come on. So it was a super awkward moment in my career, but it was he was a super good sport about it. And I was hoping maybe he'd give me the damn shoes since I put them on, but it was super weird, but I loved watching that. It was great to watch the event. But let's talk a little bit about the coming match this week. Medalist, Tiger, Phil, Tom, and Peyton. Who you guys got?
I still can't get the image of you wearing Jordan's out of my head.
Like, they're probably so big on you.
Huge.
He wears what? Size like
14,
16, 15.
17? Yeah, they're like 15s or something. I look like a clown. They were all white. I'll send you guys pictures because, of course, I took a picture of them. I mean, come on. But it was super awkward. But so, yeah, the match this weekend, guys. Let's get back on task.
The best part about it's going to be the on-course commentators. I mean, you have JT and Barkley.
Yeah.
I think Barkley's playing a hole, right?
He is. He's playing the first hole. If he makes bogey or better, I think it's like 200K to charity of his choice. So
that's a pretty cool little side bet right
there. Yeah.
I like that they're doing stuff like that. They're embracing, like, you know, more of the internet type stuff.
I think this match of the two, I think this one has the potential to blow up as far as like social media and different moments going viral. I could totally see there being at least, you know, a handful of viral moments from this one. Just because you have it's not just pro golfers here. You've got two of the biggest names in the sport. Plus you have two of the biggest names in sports, in football, in Peyton Manning and Tom Brady. Plus you have Barkley and you have Justin Thomas there. Yeah. I mean, that's a whole lot of star power for a match. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Is Barkley still playing left-handed, one-handed? That's all I want to know.
Wait,
I don't
what?
Think so.
You guys don't remember that? So this also ties back to the same course from that story about Jordan. Barkley's from Birmingham, and he was also a member out at Greystone, would show up, like, through the whole Haney project. He would show up fairly regularly to work on his game. And halfway through the Haney project, it just wasn't working out. You know, with TaylorMade, we had a super fancy camera system called the Matt system, and he was the only player I couldn't fit because the camera system software did not recognize two backswings and two through swings. So when he would get to the top of his swing and he would hitch, the cameras would time out. And so I got to call the software support company saying, what's going on here? My camera's working right there. You're like, yeah, well, let me see the movement live. They're like, yeah, we can't really deal with a hitch in your swing. But the end result of the Haney project for a while was that he ended up playing golf left-handed, but left hand only. So he didn't even have his right hand on the club. He was just swinging one-handed, left-handed. I don't think he's still
That's
playing
when you know
that
it's
way.
Gotten bad.
That's when you know you need to quit. When you get Jeez. To that point.
So I don't think he's still playing that way, though. I think he went back to two hands on the club and playing right-handed. But it'll be interesting to see what he ends up, you know, if that ends up being a total nightmare this weekend. You know, it's interesting because that hitch in his swing, It came from hitting a couple people in pro-ams. That's what it ended up coming from. He blasted a couple people.
He was
right
on our
subpar, right?
He was on our subpar podcast talking about it. He was saying that he was getting advice from so many different instructors that it started getting in his head too. And but it sounds like he's in a pretty good place mentally, and at least with his irons, the hitch isn't too bad. So
yeah,
I don't know. I think he's gonna make. I think the bet is 200K to make bogey or better, right? I think he's gonna make bogey.
Well. Hot take right there.
I believe in him.
Wow.
So let's talk about the match. You know, Tursky, who you got this weekend?
Well, it's Tiger and Peyton versus Phil and Brady, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And Peyton's, I think, from what I know, is a significantly better golfer than Tom Brady. So I got to go with Tiger and Peyton because you got to imagine that Tiger and Phil are, you know, they're going to be in the same wheelhouse, but Peyton could play, like, significantly better than Brady. So,
yeah,
Tiger and Peyton it is.
I saw Brady recently mentioned that he's struggling to break 100.
That's not good.
No, I think he's going to be on the struggle bus, especially when you've got Phil and Tiger playing in the same group and you're on television. I think he's going to struggle, but The format too is a little bit different from what I was reading up. It's going to be a four ball format on the front nine and a modified alternate shot format on the back. I think with the back they're both going to be able to tee off, and so you know, there's probably going to be side bets and stuff like that for charity, which I think will make it a lot of fun. And I mean, I'm assuming that these guys are going to be mic'd up, right?
They'd have to.
I would hope so.
Yeah. That was my one criticism of the first match was, you know, the dialogue. It was just lacking. You didn't see them giving each other,
lot,
you know,
there's
a,
not
lot of
a lot
grief.
Of like those guys aren't
oh,
you know,
true.
Those guys aren't trash talkers.
Oh, I get that, you know, but yeah. I would expect them to go a little bit outside of their regular persona when they're playing competitive golf. Granted,
yeah,
when there's $10 million on the line, they're probably not going to do that. So, You know, as far as
I think getting Brady and Peyton in the mix though will encourage a lot more trash talk.
Exactly.
Well, you also don't forget you got Barkley and JT in there too, which I'm sure being on course guys, I think there's gonna be a lot of trash talking going on. I will say I'm gonna say Justin Thomas ends up hitting at least one shot during the match.
I think the addition of JT is honestly great.
Yeah,
I think he's perfect for this.
Yeah, I love JT. You know, one of the best things about him is that, you know, in this social media era where everybody who's a professional athlete has their own social accounts, a lot of those are run by agencies. JT handles all of his own stuff.
Yep.
And, he has fun with it. So I think he's going to have a lot of fun with the broadcast.
He has a good relationship with Tiger and Phil from all the Ryder Cups, and they play matches and stuff too. So I would think he's going to do some chirping as well. Plus, he's obviously really smart when it comes to course management and talking about the match and stuff like that. So
I'd imagine JT's
going to low key be the star of this. I think.
So that
that's not a bad choice. I think Barkley's going to be the one, but JT could be sneaky.
So that's going to be interesting. No, that's going to be held at the Medalist. You guys have either of you guys played the Medalist?
I've been there before.
It is.
I've been there, but I haven't.
Brutally difficult. It is a very difficult golf course. So for Brady and Manning, brings plenty of golf balls.
Have you played the Tiger Tees there, Tim?
Dude, they're impossible. It's sillier
like
than it's sillier 7,500
plus from
it's,
the Tiger Tees.
Yeah, it's a sillier golf course to play from a difficulty standpoint than the Tiger Tees at Isleworth. You know, I played the Isleworth Collegiate Tournament back in the day, and then, you know, more recently played Isleworth with the Tiger Tees, and I was like, this is impossible. And same thing at Medalist. They're just it's so difficult. So I'll be curious to see where actually Brady and Manning are teeing up from. There's no way they're playing the Tiger Tees. No way. If they are.
You can play the Tiger Tees and it's going to be like a
7-hour round. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, the dialogue, I think having them in the mix is going to encourage more dialogue. So that'll be, you know, that'll be interesting. And then the formats.
I don't think we see any equipment changes.
No. And
I was going to bring that up.
Last part to bring up in the match. So in the four ball format, you know, on the front nine, how many times do Brady and Manning score count over Phil and Tiger's score
on the front nine?
Yeah.
One?
Maybe one hole they contribute.
They've got to be getting strokes, right?
I'd have to imagine.
They've got
to
be getting strokes.
I'd have to imagine their
handicap. So if they're getting two strokes on a hole or...
Well, yeah, if they're getting two pops, then...
Maybe they contribute.
Yeah, but...
I don't know what their handicaps are, though. But
I think Peyton's like a high single digit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure. I've seen him play. I remember the last couple of years that I've been out at Memorial. He's played in the Wednesday Pro Am. He's got a decent move.
Yeah, I saw him 1 year at Memorial. He was hooking the ball off the planet.
Yeah.
He was playing a number 18 Titleist golf ball, though. I thought that was pretty.
That's pretty
cool.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Do it.
And as far as the match, I know that we had a chance to speak with Johnny Thompson from Callaway about Phil's gear. Isn't that right, Andrew?
Yeah, we talked to Johnny Thompson, just grilling him for basically a half hour on Phil's equipment, which was really fun. Obviously, Phil's entertaining when it comes to gear, and Johnny Thompson's one of the classy guys out there on tour. So we had a great time. Let's get into it.
All right, we're excited to be welcomed by one of my favorite guys on tour, Callaway Senior PGA Tour representative Johnny Thompson. JT, thanks for taking some time out to join Fully Equipped.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, and appreciate the kind words.
Now, I know a lot of guys who would love to do what you do, but they don't even know really where the first place to start to kind of break into the industry is. What's your background in golf, and how did you end up on the Callaway Tour truck?
So I like a lot of people in my position, it started with me being a player myself. I played college golf and gave it 4 good years after college of some pretty awesome mediocre golf. And after getting sick of being broke, I decided to break into the workforce. But I got kind of lucky. I went to the PGA show and had a friend that was a sales rep for Callaway. Asked him, said, "Hey, you know, I'm hanging it up. You know, is there anything in this industry that I don't want to be a head pro? I don't want to work at a golf course, but I love the game. I have a background and a playing background. And could you see myself in any sort of fit at Callaway?" And he said, "Actually, there's his best buddy at the time was running the club specialist program at Callaway, which is our club fitting for where anybody can come in off the street and get a club fitting at our headquarters in Carlsbad." And he got me an interview there. And then I ended up flying out to Callaway a couple weeks later for a second round of interviews. And then wasn't even sure if I wanted to do it because I was going to be moving to California, which was pretty bizarre for me because I pretty much lived in Florida my whole life. And after going out there and visiting and doing the interview, I flew back going, "I have to get this job," because I thought Carlsbad was the coolest place in the world. And got lucky and started out as a club specialist, and then a position opened up in the tour department, and I ended up getting lucky and gotten to be, I was a LPGA tour rep for Callaway in 2008 and 2009. And then I worked on at that time, the web.com in 2010. And then from 11 on, I've been on the PGA tour.
Where did you play your college golf at?
I was at the University of North Florida in Jacksonville, Florida, Fighting Ospreys.
Nice. I like that nickname.
Such a good mascot.
Yeah.
Pretty awesome. It's we got some good logos.
When I see you at a tour event, it seems like you're always on the move, bouncing around, running from the range to the tour truck. How would you describe the job of a tour rep and kind of what your day-to-day looks like?
Yeah, you're right. We rarely stop moving. Once our feet hit the ground on Monday morning, we're pretty busy. But day in and day out, I mean, our first priority at Callaway is to take care of our staff players and make sure that, you know, those guys are playing the equipment that takes them to their best and gives them their best chance of competing at the highest level. And then outside of that, we have a ton of players that might not wear a Callaway hat or carry a Callaway bag, but play our product. And so we're servicing guys who choose to play Callaway on their own. And we're there for those guys as well. We do a lot of marketing stuff on site too. We'll try to help out where we can with the marketing team, but our number one goal is, as soon as we step foot on site, is to be an asset for our staff players and make sure that they're playing their best.
You know, Johnny, the first time that I met you, it was probably 8 years ago, and you were doing putters for Odyssey at the time, if I remember correctly. Now I know you're doing clubs on the Callaway side. What was the transition like? How long did it take you to get acclimated to going from putters to doing clubs? And do you miss doing putters at all on a full-time basis?
Yeah, I mean, the transition wasn't that hard because for 3 years, I did everything on the LPGA and the web.com. So it wasn't like a completely unfamiliar territory for me. And then the other thing was my almost 2 years of like my upbringing at Callaway, my DNA at Callaway has been fitting. That's what I did at headquarters. It's kind of where I feel like I came from. And then the Odyssey thing was awesome because it was an opportunity for me to go from a rep that did everything to very specialized. And I mean, I absolutely adored it. I think I did it for 5 or 6 years. And it was awesome because I was just hyper-focused on putting and putters. So it gave me a chance to learn a lot. I got to work with great players, got to work with great coaches like Phil Kenyon. It was really cool to be a part of some of these guys' teams where I learned a lot myself just working with these guys. And I felt like I honed my skills to a pretty high level. I was I felt very confident on the green, and I was part of a few very, really good players, some of the top players in the world. I was part of their team when it came to putters and putting, and that was pretty fulfilling. But yeah, the transition wasn't that hard because, again, it was something that I've done in the past, and I, at the time, kind of missed, to be honest with you. everybody wants to sit on a driving range and watch guys just rip drivers. So I sometimes find myself on the putting green looking over like, oh, who's hitting balls, you know? It was pretty cool.
Obviously, some craziness going on in the world right now. With the new social distancing rules in place, how's your job and interaction with the players going to be different, if you know?
But yeah, so in terms of the new rules with social distancing, reading through the tour's new regulations on everything, I mean, I was completely impressed with how the PGA Tour is handling this, and I feel that they've done everything. I read through 30 pages and I couldn't find one thing that I thought maybe wasn't, you know, going to work or, you know, wasn't the best idea. I mean, they really did a great job of providing what I think is a pretty safe atmosphere for the players to play in and for us to work in. You know, we're still going to have trucks on site. We're still going to have reps on site. We're going to definitely be doing things different at Callaway from a sanitation side of things. A lot more steps added with product coming in, product coming off the truck. But yeah, it'll look different, but the results should be the same. And that's, I feel like we're going to give some pretty exemplary service week in and week out.
Yeah, we're excited to get back out there. Obviously, we're burying the lead a little bit. We got Phil Mickelson playing in the match coming up against Tiger. Got Tom Brady and Peyton playing. You work with a lot of high-profile guys you have throughout your career. But what's it like working with Phil? And is he as big of a gearhead as it seems to the outsiders?
He really kind of is, because when he gets his hands on something new and it excites him, it like excites like what a 12-year-old would feel like, you know, or like at Christmas time, you know, it gets like that one thing that he was begging Santa for. Like Phil gets that kind of excitement when you put something in his hands and it works and he feels like he's going to be better from it. So in that sense, it's super fun to work with because you can kind of see it in his face. You can see it in his reactions. He gets pretty excited when he tests new drivers or fairway woods and things like that, when he sees a gain in control or in distance.
When was the first time you started working with Phil? And do you have any early memories of the first couple of interactions you had with him?
Yeah, so when I first started on the LPGA tour, I was so nervous to talk to Annika. I was nervous to talk to Julie Inkster, you know, like, cause like growing up, like these were the women that I watched on TV and admired, you know, the Meg Mallons and things like that. I was equally as nervous when I had to meet and work with Phil for the first time, but it was different because I had sort of, I had a little help on the side, but Jimmy McKay, his longtime caddy Bones, is from my hometown, and he is actually my babysitter growing up.
So
I always, like, Jimmy and I have been great friends forever, and his family and our family are very close, very good friends. And so when I started working on the PGA Tour, and I mean, growing up, I was the biggest Phil fan in the world. I love everything about how he conducts himself on the golf course, to how he plays, like everything. So I was super nervous, but I knew that it was going to be a little bit easier because Jimmy was such a good friend, and he kind of would like help bring me into the circle, and at least kind of I had to earn my way in there, but I had Jimmy to assist. So it was nerve-wracking, but Jimmy always made it easier for me. And so yeah, once I started getting in there, and I did some putter stuff with him early on. I remember my first true interaction was probably at Pinehurst, the US Open, that Martin Keimer won. I can't remember the year, but that was where I kind of felt I actually had the confidence to go up to Jimmy and go up to Phil and say, hey, I'm seeing something. And you know, and that kind of helped me, I feel like, get into the circle with those guys from a performance and equipment level. But I always felt comfortable around him because Jimmy was always standing right there.
Okay, so Bones is one of the best caddies in the history of the game. What's he like as a babysitter? Is he as adept?
Yeah, I mean, I was really young. Really young. So I don't have as clear of memories, but my dad played on tour in the 70s and early 80s. So, and Jimmy was a local high school kid, you know, and my dad was just took a liking to Jimmy, you know, who's a high school kid out here when my dad would be, you know, off season in the winter playing at our local muni. And he just kind of took Jimmy under his wing and would take him out and play. And so that kind of started the whole relationship with the Mackay family. Yeah, it was, he did pretty good. I turned out okay, not too bad.
I know you both ended up out there on tour.
Yeah, I'm sure we would have much rather been on the other maybe, side of the bag, but you know, take what you can get.
So, you know, I know a lot of people, a lot of gearheads especially, they know Phil tinkers with his gear a lot, but they see him outside of the truck. How much time does he spend inside of it in a given week? Is he in there at all, kind of just fooling around with stuff?
Yeah, so Phil lives in really close proximity to our headquarters in Carlsbad, California, and he has a great relationship with a ton of people at Callaway, but specifically our Ely Callaway Performance Center. Randy Peterson, Garrett Pond, John Deegan, those guys get to work with him pretty regularly when he's home. So whenever we have new product coming out, generally they're the ones to introduce it to him because he's right there. And then once he comes out on tour, if he needs work, we always are given a heads up, like, hey, Phil's going to come in for, you know, he's looking for this or looking for that. We get a little bit of a heads up. But generally speaking, when he shows up on site, he's kind of ready to go, unless it's something where he's already been on the road and this is like the second or third event of a stretch. He usually shows up pretty ready to go. So if he pops in, it's usually just to say, hey, guys, what's up? And, you know, shoot the bull for a little bit, which he's the best at. And other than that, yeah, if he's in there, it's for a pretty specific need, but he's not one to just hang out, you know, too long.
How much input does he have on new designs that Callaway comes out with? Like, is he a trusted source of feedback for you guys?
Yeah. And to be fair, I'd say every single one of our players is considered a trusted source. We got a lot of, you know, really intelligent guys on staff, and we got a lot of local people, you know, close to Carlsbad. Xander Schauffele lives right down the street. Emiliano Grillo lives right down the street. So we use a lot of guys in that sense in terms of product development and seeing where we need to go and testing prototypes and whatnot. We use all those guys, to be honest, because, you know, Phil's always his own player. Xander's his own player, but you know, the more you get a chance to have those kind of interactions with that high level player, you know, it helps you encompass everybody. You can kind of fit everybody from, you know, from Phil to Xander. So yeah, it's he definitely has a part in it. You know, the wedges is different. The PM grind was definitely, I'd say he owns that one quite well. But when it comes to like wood product stuff like that, our R&D team are there to listen to our tour players. And then for the ones that are in close proximity, some of those guys get to hit and test and provide feedback in early stages. And then after that, it's our whole tour team gets to generally have an idea or a say in sort of what direction we're going.
Speaking of Xander, he's kind of unique because his dad was like a golf club designer, right? So does he have like an elevated knowledge of equipment from your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite refreshing too, because he's his coach as well. And so nobody knows Xander's golf swing as good as Stefan does. And then with his knowledge of equipment design and more or less cause and effect, which is, I think, the most important thing in fitting, is understanding is just true cause and effect of golf balls and wood design. Those kind of things, you're not trying to teach him something. Like he knows what you're talking about when you talk about different impact locations or you make one change to a golf club, what it's going to produce, at impact, what to expect. He knows all that stuff. So it's kind of, it makes it easier to work with him, to be honest. And then with him knowing Xander better than anybody, we tend to get down the road a lot faster with those three. Or with three of us together, working together, because everybody is pretty much knowledgeable of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to Phil, because we kind of all love Phil because, he's reckless in his play on the course. He'll go for anything, and it seems like when it's equipment, he'll try anything. We need some crazy Phil equipment stories. Anything that you can remember that sticks out where it's just like, whoa, what is he even thinking?
I mean, not like crazy, to be honest. I mean, cause everything, he's never come in and asked for something that we just, like, after he left, we were all like looking at each other like, what? Like that's, there's always been a specific purpose. And then the other thing too, is we have a very good relationship with his coach, Andrew Getson. So we've always had this really good understanding of when Phil needs something, we get an idea or a heads up on what he needs, and we're already starting to turn, the gears are starting to turn on where we need to go. And so if he comes in and does ask for something, we already kind of have an idea what the background is. But in terms of like something wild and crazy, I wouldn't say anything on the like woods or iron side, but he did for a while. He came out when Keegan Bradley came out and kind of burst onto the scene with the belly putter. I mean, he basically was synonymous with our saber-tooth belly putter. It was like, that was Keegan's putter. And him and Phil got to have a pretty good relationship. They partnered up in the Ryder Cup, and I don't know if it was just Keegan maybe getting the best of Phil in some matches, but Phil decided he wanted to try a saber-tooth belly putter. And our lead design guy at Odyssey at the time, Aussie Rawlinson, like welded, had to take a right, because we didn't even make it in left-handed, so he had to take a right-handed head, slice the hosel off, re-weld it on the left side of the golf club. And we were lucky because that head was for the most part symmetrical, so you could do it. And he welded a hosel on the spud on the left-handed side, and then had to get it was a very specific pocket shape for that insert. So then the hard part was getting the Odyssey logo on the heel, so it wasn't sitting out on the toe. I mean, it was just like, he jumped through a lot of hoops to get this putter made. And I remember Phil came out at Boston, which would have been, it was Deutsche Bank. I don't even know if that was a playoff. It might've been a playoff by then, but anyways, he came out and he played in on the Wednesday pro-am, and Jimmy called me and said, hey, Phil wants you to come watch him hit some putts. He wants to learn a little bit more about this belly putter thing. And this was the first time that it might've been the first time that I really did work with him. I know, like I mentioned, the US Open thing, that was when I was like, I interjected myself into something. This is him calling me in, and it was the first time. And I was like, holy cow. Like, this guy's asking me about ball position and where his eyes are and what he should be feeling. And I'm like, dude, you're Phil Mickelson. Like, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you what you should be feeling, but I'll give it my best. And that was probably the funniest thing, is just watching him try to wheel it around that belly putter, that saber-tooth belly putter. And I think he used it, not the whole event. I want to say he only used it for a round or two, but that was pretty funny, I thought.
Did you have anything to do with the Phil's most famous clubs, probably that Frankenwood? Did you have anything to do with that?
No, that was before my time on the wood side of things. I was still doing putters then, but that was Doc Hawk back in the lab working on some things for Phil. That was pretty cool. That thing still shows up every now and then. It surprises us. It'll show up and it'll be in the bag every now and then.
I must have missed that.
It hadn't made like the, it didn't make the game time, but it showed up a couple times just to like threaten the other clubs in the bag.
Interesting.
All right. So we know Phil based on his clubs. He's a big fan of lead tape, and it's got a purpose. But as we've talked about on the podcast before, you know, you gotta know where to put it. Is Phil the kind of guy? Is he come into the truck and talking about positioning of that lead tape, or does he just do it himself? And also, what's he have as far as hot melt in his driver specifically?
He basically does all that himself. Like a lot of times when he shows up with those things, you know, covered in lead tape or, you know, whatever, it's usually stuff that he does practicing and working with things at home. You know, the beauty about lead tape is you can move a CG around pretty good with lead tape. You can change the ball flight, you know, pretty consistently by moving lead tape around. But once you know, if you're trying to do the same thing in hot melt, that you put it in one place and decide it doesn't work, well, that golf club's done. You're not going to, you know, move it back around. So I know a lot of people call lead tape old school, but to me, I mean, lead tape is great in fitting and great in learning a new product because you can move it around. You know, if it doesn't work, you take it off and replace whatever weight you took out to make up for the added lead. And I don't know if Phil, if that's why he goes that route, if that's the reasoning, but it is awful easy and hot melt's pretty dangerous too. I really don't want to hear that Phil is at home, you know, shooting hot melt into his golf clubs, because that stuff gets on your hand. You're not going to feel real good. So I would prefer him to use lead tape.
Probably speaking from experience too.
Yeah. You get all those little drops on you and you'll know it. But in terms of hot melt for Phil, so going back a few years, he did used to use a decent amount in the heel of his golf club and forward heel to keep spin down and then to help him square the face up, you know, and create a little bit of a draw bias for him. And as him and Andrew Getson have worked the last 3 or 4 years together, and what we've noticed with Phil is he's gone away from less and less need of a draw bias. His path and his face rotation has gotten a lot tighter, a lot more neutral. So there isn't as big of a need to help him sort of release the club. It's happening naturally through technique. So I have found that we are doing less and less hot melt in drivers for Phil, which is great because I think that's something that they're pretty happy to see. It was sort of a progression for those guys to knowing that if Phil swung the golf club the way that Andrew and him wanted the golf club to be swung, there wasn't a need for all that, you know, kind of help that he was getting from loading up the heel with hot glue.
So Phil's pretty open-minded, willing to experiment with gear. Is there anybody else out on tour that kind of fits into a similar box who's also kind of willing to experiment and pretty open-minded when it comes to testing?
I mean, I feel like everybody has a little bit of them because I'm pretty proud of, you know, working for Callaway Golf. And I feel like every year we take what we have and we learn from it. And then we implement it into the next line of woods. So a lot of players do get excited. I mean, I know Mark Leishman loves to hit new drivers. He thinks it's just fun for him to see new things and test out new things. Well, this would be a good one. Brandon Grace is probably right up there with a lot of them who just gets really geeked out on new stuff. Trying to think. I think everybody has a little bit of it in them, but nobody who's just like, you know, completely out of their minds over new stuff. I think those guys are kind of excited to see new things. And then we have some guys that once they have something that they really like, they don't want to have to ever change it, but they know that that's just not how it really usually works. But yeah, not that great of an answer, I guess.
What's the one thing in Phil's current setup that you think would surprise a gearhead?
I would say probably playing those Epic Forged irons, which are he plays them in the long to mid irons. I would say that most people at retail would probably look at those and think that they're like a high end sort of, you know, average player club. But if they pulled them off the rack and look at them, they don't have a lot of offset. It's a nice, clean player looking iron, but they are long. You know, they're designed to go far. I think that's kind of a surprise to a lot of people that he would play that kind of an iron. He does use more of a traditional cavity back blade in our Apex Pro line from 8, 9 and pitching wedge. But those mid irons, he does use our Epic Forge, which are pretty long irons.
I was kind of surprised. I think it was maybe late last year, early this year, where he's been playing like an 88-02 style putter for like years and years and years. And then he comes out with the Stroke Lab mallet. Did that surprise you, or did that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, the Stroke Lab mallet, the Stroke Lab 10 with the triple track lines, that we weren't surprised because, one, he used triple track golf ball, which used the ball and the putter, and it makes alignment super easy. And the you can't deny the fact that 10 was becoming one of our most popular shapes, and people notice that, and they kind of create some curiosity. Obviously has toe hang nowhere near the amount that his old school blade does. But I think at the time, you know, there was some things that probably intrigued him, and, you know, he's at a point in his career where if he wants to give something a try and it doesn't work out, it's not that big of a deal if he, you know, loses out on an event. But, I wasn't that surprised that he tried it because it was still is a pretty hot putter. But yeah, he's traditionally always used either that blade style or the Versa 9. And he goes back, the Versa 9 has a line milled on it, and the 8802 style is blank. So that's one of the things that he bounces back and forth is if he wants to use a line, he uses the Versa 9. If he wants nothing, he uses the blade, the old school traditional blade. And then a lot of times too, if he gets on greens that are mega fast, he'll lean towards the blade as well. Whereas greens, mid to slow for PGA Tour standards, he'll go with the Versa usually, just for the release and feel and weighting of it. I guess he likes that putter for when he feels like he has to hit things a little bit harder. The blade is sort of the smooth, milky kind of just let the putter fall into the back of the ball feel.
He always stays with the same insert, right?
Mm-hmm. For the most part, yeah. It's an old, I think it was from our XG line.
Is that kind of a headache, always changing out that insert for him?
You qualify for the PGA Tour, and honestly, they're willing to do – you get some extra things done if needed. He's no different than, you know, if any of our players wanted to put an older insert into a putter. For the most part, we would do that if that's what they felt made them a better putter. Because in the end, I mean, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to take these guys and elevate their games to the highest level. So, you know, a guy used a white hot insert and, you know, 5 years ago and was the best putter he ever putted with, and then we come out with a new shape, you know, down the road, yeah, generally we might build one with an old white hot insert and just to appease.
Right. Is he a big track man guy? Like, how much does he rely on numbers, and how do his numbers kind of stack up against the other guys you work with?
Yeah, he hasn't, I'd say he got his TrackMan maybe 2 years ago, and definitely not longer than that. It was like between 1 and 2 years ago. So he hasn't been a big TrackMan guy. He loves distance, and he loves to feel like he can bring it. And so I think he's really liked having TrackMan because he can practice his swing speed. He uses a lot of his training and warm up routines. It's a lot of speed stuff. So for him, I think he likes it because it's an immediate reaction to, you know, the work he's doing off course to create more speed. So if he can see if his speed's up or down. But I think Phil uses it like the majority of PGA Tour players that use TrackMan to its benefit is, carry yardage, actual yard, normalized numbers, and then actual numbers kind of gauging, you know, what that location is creating, the difference between normalized and actual carry yardages. So I think guys have gotten pretty good at their distance control and just understanding, you know, limitations on their clubs just through TrackMan and looking at those carry numbers. And Phil will use it for that.
He likes the bombs.
That's right. It's all about the bombs. You know, tour players obviously have different wants and needs than a 15 handicapper. But is there anything about Phil's current setup that you would say, if you were talking to a 15 handicapper, hey, look at this part of Phil's bag because you might be able to kind of glean something or benefit from something he's doing with his current setup?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Phil's been one. Like, he's not afraid to, if he thinks some long irons in one model work and the middle irons work in another iron and then short irons work, you know, in another model work better, best for him, he's not afraid to piece it together. I mean, he's had sort of that combo look for a while now. So I think, you know, a 15 handicapper, they might need a little help with the longer clubs, you know, elevating the ball and getting it up in the air. So if they want to, you know, use a game improvement 3, 4, and 5 iron, but then, you know, sort of a middle of the road, like, you know, your standard Maverick iron from 6 through wedge, you know, something like that. Like, there's, I think Phil shows that you don't have to just stick to, you know, one model 3 iron through pitching wedge. I think it's kind of cool that he's not afraid to go and find each part of a set that works best for him and not afraid to mix it up. Kind of creates his own combo sets out of it.
Have you ever played in or been a part of one of the famous, like, Phil matches, you know, that he plays early in the week or off-site or anything like that?
No, and I wish I was, but our other rep that worked on PGA Tour with me for a long time, Mike Soroka, he's our manager on the Korn Ferry Tour now, he did get to play with him, and it's a great story because if you know Soroka, he doesn't get to play as much golf, and he was an awesome college player. He still is a great player, but he got the call from at the time, our VP of marketing, sports marketing, and said, hey, I'm meeting Phil, and I can't remember who the other player was, and they needed a fourth. He said, do you want to play? This was like late at night, and it was the plan the next day, like 8 o'clock. And he's like, yeah, I'll play. He hadn't played in a while, and Soroka bombs it. He hits it hard, but he said he was so nervous he had to have a couple vodka OJs in the morning after he got to the golf course just to calm down because he was like freaking out. And they stepped up on the first tee, and what did he say? So Phil goes, all right, like, what are we going to play? Like, Soroka, what's your handicap? He goes, did you play college golf? And he goes, yeah, I played at Southern Miss. And Phil immediately snaps back and goes, okay, so you're like a 5. And Soroka was dying laughing. And so Soroka bombed it on the first hole past Phil, makes birdie, and Phil kind of snarks off on him. And then the second hole, he makes another birdie, and it was either the third or the fourth hole. I can't remember. I think it was the third. It was a par 3. Steps up, and Soroka flags it in the middle of the air. It looks like it's doing nothing but going in the hole. And Phil gave him a few choice words while the ball was in the air. And it landed pretty close, and he ended up making it. So I think he birdied the first 3 holes on Phil. And being like so nervous, he had to have a vodka OJ before he teed off.
I'd probably walk off the golf course if I birdied the first 3 holes with Phil Mickelson there in attendance.
So unfortunately, I don't have any stories, but I did. I felt like I lived that one because Soroka called me on the way to the golf course, and as soon as he got done to tell me that story, I thought that was pretty awesome.
That is wild.
Did you work at all with Arnold Palmer?
No, but kind of, because Sam and I had a really good relationship from the very beginning when Sam Saunders turned pro and was on the Callaway staff. You know, he was in Orlando. I'm in New Smyrna Beach, Florida, which is barely an hour away. So I started doing a lot of stuff with Sam early on. And we started by a working relationship, but then from there created a pretty strong friendship. So I spent a lot of time with Sam. And if we had anything coming up in the pipeline, I would go over to Bay Hill and meet Sam over there. And then sometimes Arnold would be there, and had a couple interactions on the range with him that I'll never forget. You know, he was being in his presence, like, you knew, you could feel how special of a person he was. And he was so nice, and he was funny. And I mean, he was older when, you know, some of these times that I had with him, he was a lot older, but he was still sharp as a tack. And he'd throw some lines out there that you just start dying laughing because he was just, he was aware of everything going on around. He was a cool guy.
Yeah, I met him one time when I was like 15 or 16. I was super tall and skinny. He was like, "You look like a human one iron."
I'll never forget that. So fun. Yeah, sharp as a tack.
Awesome. Yeah, he was the man. I think his legacy is awesome. I'm happy to be friends with Sam, and you know, I was happy to get to know Arnold through Sam.
Yeah, it's great.
That's awesome. This is great, Johnny. Thanks for the time. And that'll do it for episode 44 of Fully Equipped. Thanks again to Johnny Thompson for the time. If you want to check us out on social media for the latest gear news, we're at Fully Equipped Golf on Instagram and at Fully_Equipped on Twitter. Thanks again for listening. See you next week.